Debug is brought to you today by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/debug and enter offer code debug at checkout. A better web starts with your website.
You know, I'm actually having a little bit of red wine this afternoon.
Oh, so. Classy fella.
Yeah. Well, if you must know, it's actually red wine out of a box. So
perfect.
Maybe not that classy.
That's the kind of show we are.
That's fine.
I have very mid-range taste buds, so you know, I can drink mid-range wines and things like that.
Right. Yeah. It's good enough. So you're a famous actor. How did you get into acting?
Well, you know, a long time ago when I was born in Kenya. I'm sure you're referring to the actual famous Nitin or Nitin Ganatra. Interestingly, we've actually made contact with each other over the years. In fact, I have a picture of him. I'm not sure if you know this, but, there were some ads that were done for the iPod back in like 2001 and it was 2000, 2001, something like that. And Nitin Ganatra was the actor in it. He was the, you know, Indian-ish looking guy kind of dancing to, I think it was like Propeller Heads or something like that. It was, you know, I think it was part of the Rip Mix Burn campaign. And a friend of mine who worked in product marketing, she got a chance to talk to him. And so I got this Polaroid from him that says, to Nitin Ganatra from Nitin Ganatra. I still have that. So, and even today we follow each other on Twitter and, you know, just kind of, you know, make comments back and forth and things like that. Although we've never actually met, but yeah, it's a little odd having what I used to always think was, you know, a somewhat, you know, obscure name only to find out that, sure, you know, it's the same name as the celebrity.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. Like if anybody out there Googles you right now, they're going to find out that you've got a pretty successful acting career.
Right. I'm really a Renaissance man.
Oh, so I guess you program then. So kind of boring.
Yeah.
But yeah. So how'd you get into technology?
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I mean,
Right. Reconstruct it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give this to you in real time. You know, it started when I was 9 years old, and no, it was really my first exposure to anything related to technology was, you know, what was Apple IIs. You know, they were the Apple IIs that we had in our elementary school, and you know, we had these at the time. It was these horrible text based games, but that was kind of what we had. The first one that I think stands out was a game. I think it was just called it was either called Trek or Star Trek. It was one of these, you know, it was a very early Apple II game. I think it's like 1979 we're talking about here. And it was just fascinating that, you know, here's this machine that I had only ever seen in, you know, like in pictures in magazines or in, you know, on, you know, important people's desks or, you know, things like that. And look, you know, we get to play with it too. And not only do we get to actually use this thing, but we're playing a game on it. You know, it was just, you know, just the whole concept of video games at that time was just, you know, was so new too. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, as a little boy, you know, you get to play games for the first time, it was just phenomenal. So, I mean, that was my first exposure. I didn't really get into programming and things like that until I got my own Apple II, which was a few years later. I think I was, I don't remember, 12 or 13 years old, and I had I believe it was a 2+. But I did have an 80 column card in it. So, you know, right, there was that.
That's exactly what I had.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And same here too.
Yeah. Nice. You know, and it was great because it had AppleSoft built in, right? And it had this other bizarro, you know, integer basic thing built in, but I never really wasted time with integer basic. It was all AppleSoft. You know, that was, it seemed like that was,
I don't know who did. I don't even remember what the purpose of integer basic was.
Yeah, exactly. I remember even at that time, it kind of felt like it was this weird thing that it didn't seem as, you know, well documented as AppleSoft, and it was different enough and it was all uncomfortable enough that I just didn't want to be, you know, messing with something that didn't seem like it was, you know, as well documented. But yeah, you're right. I wondered the same thing. Like, who the hell did they make Integer Basic for? And why is it still on this machine if, you know, if there's this thing called AppleSoft on here?
Yeah, like my theory was it was like that's for the big people. Like the grown-ups use Integer Basic.
Oh.
I'm like peddling with like the real one, like the, you know, the one that I'm supposed to be using.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way, but I could see how, you know, that would come across. Like, this is AppleSoft is Kitty Basic and Integer is, you know, a man's Basic, or, you know, yeah, grown-up Basic. I mean,
yeah, it has a big word in front of it, so.
That's true.
I was pretty young at the time. You know, I hadn't even realized that, yeah, you'd probably not be using Basic at all to write anything sensible. But so it was Basic your first language, and how long did you run with it?
Yeah. So Basic was my first language. You know, it started with dopey little programs and getting, gosh, I forget what the magazines were called. I think there was one called Apple Insider or Apple Cider, maybe. It was CIDER, something like that.
Okay.
You know, where they had the huge, you know, the multi-page listings of Basic programs.
Yep.
And even at that time, it was funny now looking back, you know, just kind of realizing that, well, you know, they had these things called Go Subs, and there were these Go Subs everywhere. And what the heck, you know, I never used a Go Sub in my, you know, in the early days of AppleSoft anyway, I never used a Go Sub anywhere. It was just kind of, you know, you just start at the, you know, execution starts at the top and you go down to the bottom and that's it, you know. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't until a couple of years later when I started playing with Apple Pascal, with UCSD Pascal, that I saw the value of having, you know, these things called subroutines and, you know, breaking programs into little functional units and, you know, and things like that. So yeah, it was AppleSoft for, you know, at least 3 or 4 years there, and even a little bit of assembly, of some 6502 assembly, because Yeah, exactly. You know, that's on your path to manhood is, you know, you have to, I don't know, you have to do something very, very difficult, I guess. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, it's just, I mean, you inevitably hit a wall with AppleSoft where you want to do something cool. You know it can happen. And I think they gave you the manual, didn't they? Like the ring-bound manual had all of the opcodes and stuff in it.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually a good point. And I think that was really the motivation for it was, you know, like you said, you know, at some point, you know, you kind of run into limits around, well, you know, how fast can I, you know, draw graphics to the screen? You know, and in Basic, you really can't draw them too fast. And it was sort of why are my programs so slow and shitty? Yet, you know, there are these games now that are starting to come out where, you know, things are just bouncing all around the screen. And how do they do that? You know, and the answer was always assembly. And, you know, it was just this cryptic thing. And yeah, so that was sort of my first exposure. I, you know, unfortunately, I never got as far at that point as, you know, writing a game or doing anything more than, you know, maybe a page or two or a screenful or two of assembly. But yeah, it was.
Right. Yeah. You know, but you're already doing it right because you use assembly where you need to and NOM where you don't. So
right.
Good discipline. Good discipline there. So you got into the Pascal side of things. On the Apple II, or is this?
Yeah, that was also on the Apple II. There was, you know, the Apple II that I had. I mean, I had a disk drive, but I didn't have two, and I certainly didn't have four. You know, for UC, I'm not sure if you ever used UCSD Pascal, but at the time, I mean, if you wanted to compile something, you had to stick in another floppy. You know, and then when you wanted to link, you know, your program, you had to take out that floppy and stick in a third floppy. You know, and when you wanted to bring up the editor, you had to go back to, you know, I think the first floppy. I mean, it was really, you know, the compile run cycle. There was no debug, as far as I recall. Anyway, I never, you know, debugged at that time. So really the compile run cycle was, you know, this three floppy thing, which, I mean, it, you know, looking back, of course, it was awful. But, you know, that was sort of the, you know, at this point now, it's, you know, my second experience with a high level language, but Pascal just felt like, I mean, it felt so much more natural than, you know, than AppleSoft. And so, you know, and it was kind of hard for me to, you know, and it required these three floppies and it was from, you know, this university. And so of course this is, you know, this is real, you know, big boy computing here, you know? So, you know, and just the idea, you know, and Pascal just made it so easy to, you know, create functions or procedures and, you know, pass arguments and, you know, I don't even, you know, all the data
records,
structures.
And,
records. Yeah. It just really...
I still have a soft spot for Pascal.
It's
one of the, like, like I basically graduated from BASIC into doing Turbo Pascal on the PC, and you could do inline assembly on it. And so I wrote so many games in Pascal, and I don't know, like it seems like it gets a little bit maligned, but it's great in so many ways.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, and even when we were, you know, even, you know, much, much later in life when we, you know, when I, you know, went to Apple and started working there, right? You know, there were definitely pockets of people there who, you know, who felt like, well, why did we give up this Pascal thing? I mean, it was a, you know, the language, you know, just, you know, it didn't have all these, you know, these pitfalls that you had in C, and, you know, the compiler was, you know, was better, and the, you know, just the environment was a little bit nicer. And, you know, it felt like a lot of people sort of felt like it was a step backwards. And I remember feeling that same way and just having a soft spot for Pascal.
Yeah, I don't know if Objective-C is a step backwards in Pascal, but for, I don't know. Some people just rag on it all the time, and I don't think it deserves it. I think it serves its purpose well.
Oh, and I'm sorry. And to be clear, I mean, I was just talking about people who are comparing MPWC to MPW-Pascal. You know,
okay.
And then there was this new thing called C++, which was just, you know, just had these horrific compilers. You know, and all of that. You know, on the MP, you know, and especially in the early 90s, you know, well, we can get to that later, but yeah, it was, it, I mean,
yeah, that's a much more apt comparison. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, like go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Like the original Mac was all built around the Pascal toolbox.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's hard for me to now, you know, kind of go in there and look because, you know, well, again, much later, you know, I sort of expected this wonderful world, you know, of you know, something that looked like, you know, somewhere between UCSD Pascal and Think Pascal, you know, as being the entire operating system was written in this glorious, you know, language, and, you know, and getting to Apple was, you know, it was kind of an eye opener, right? Just realizing what it really was, but we can get to that later too.
Yeah, we'll end up in the sausage factory eventually. you haven't done any programming in school yet by this point, right?
Let's see. You know, so I think the Pascal was actually when I started to learn Pascal, that was actually there was a summer school type program that I had taken that I was taking, and I think that was, you know, either late in middle school or maybe early in high school. It was somewhere around there. I think it was late middle school when I was learning Pascal, and that was in a, you know, in a learning environment, but, you know, it was, you know, obviously, you know, you learn for 2 hours and then you go home and plunk away for 4 or 5 hours until you get tired of exchanging floppies and find something else to do.
So the bug caught you early, like the iterative programming bug.
It did catch me early. In fact, I mean, in some ways it may have caught me a little too early, because by the time I was, you know, I think I was, by the time I was a junior in high school, I was sort of, you know, I kind of felt like I was done with computers. You know, I sort of felt like, I mean, obviously I hadn't learned, you know, anywhere near everything that I needed to. I mean, there was so much that I, you know, obviously didn't know, and, you know, that so many things that I hadn't done, but, you know, I had sort of learned enough to kind of, you know, satisfy me and kind of, you know, and I sort of became comfortable in, you know, in the little world that I understood, and kind of felt like, okay, maybe I'll go look at other things, like, you know, I don't know, playing tennis or, you know, hanging out with friends or, you know, watching music videos. I don't know, you know, things like that.
No, that totally rings true for me, because I did anthropology and history in university because I really didn't want a computer job. Turns out I did want a computer job, and they're awesome. But, like, from the other side of the fence, you can see it being kind of boring or staid. And, like, it was my hobby, and I didn't necessarily want to sully my hobby by doing it all day.
Yeah. You know, and that's funny. That's really funny, because that's very similar to you know, what I feel happened to me too, where, yeah, it was my hobby and it was this thing that I was interested in, but, you know, I guess I just didn't really have a picture in my mind of, you know, of going to a, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, I guess, you know, I was a little dopey kid, but, you know, I just couldn't imagine going to an office somewhere and doing computery stuff all day. You know,
yeah,
and
it seemed incredibly boring, right?
Yeah, it seemed kind of boring, and yeah, exactly. You know, and it was, and yes, and like you said, you know, it was taking my hobby, this thing that was interested, that I was interested in, and now it's become labor, you know?
Right.
And yeah, that's funny.
But eventually you did. So what happened? What did you do in university?
Yeah. So by the time I, you know, got around to, you know, applying to, you know, colleges and things like that, you know, like I said, I'd sort of put computers aside and, you know, decided it was more, you know, it was time to kind of grow up and do something, you know, I don't know, more grown up or God knows what, you know. Right. But long story short, I started applying for, you know, I had taken a couple of economics classes in high school and some history courses, and I was really, you know, more interested in that and particularly on the economic side, really sort of the, you know, how human behavior is impacted by, you know, kind of an economic environment. And
that's,
you know,
interesting. Is that like sort of the thrill of systems from the programming? Is there like a kernel of commonality there?
You know, I'm not really sure. Maybe there
I'm not trying to like, I don't want to psychoanalyze you over Skype or anything, but
no, you know, it's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it that way. I mean, up until now, well, and we can get to it, but, you know, so I'm not really sure that there may be something to that, but I feel like it was really kind of music that sort of brought me back into computers later when I was in college. Yeah, so I went into, you know, I went into college. I went to, you know, I went to UC Santa Cruz as, you know, in the economics program. I went to Crown College there, for anybody who knows UC Santa Cruz. And very quickly after that, went to Kresge, which was sort of the art school. After, you know, I think I took, you know, maybe two quarters worth of economics courses and realized that, oh my God, that, you know, the part that I'm interested in, I'm never going to get past all this mundane crap, you know, to get to the part that I'm really interested in. And
right. Like the high level human behavioral stuff is fascinating.
Yeah.
And then you've got all of the, like, the, you know, the nuts and bolts of day-to-day economics, which is kind of a drag.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, the elastic versus inelastic, you know, spending, right, and the macroeconomics and micro. And I mean, it was just, you know, it just wasn't anywhere near as interesting as I imagined it was. And it certainly wasn't as interesting as, you know, the courses I had taken in high school. So, you know, after my first year, it was pretty clear that I wasn't, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be an econ major, but I really didn't know what I was going to be either.
And
it was around that time that I had, you know, started, you know, that I had picked up the guitar and started learning how to play guitar. I'm not sure if the same is true in Canada, but in you know, in American universities, and especially for, you know, for freshmen and sophomores, you know, there's plenty of time during the day to do things other than studying.
Yes. And if there's not, well, you'll just make time. It's fine.
And yes, exactly. And even if there really shouldn't be that much time, yes, like you said, yeah, you will make that time, and, you know, maybe fail a class here or there, or,
right,
or things like that. So yeah, it was really after, you know, I had kind of, you know, my first, second, and even part of my, you know, first and second years really in college, you know, it was clear I wasn't going to go into computers or into economics. Computers was already this thing that I had just dismissed long before I ever got to college. And, you know, then it was sort of, well, you know, political science is kind of interesting. You know, I was doing, you know, I was taking more and more courses in, you know, in history and poli sci. But, you know, that even that was, there was something very unsatisfying about it. And it was really, you know, when I got into, you know, I had taken some, I think, some creative writing, you know, elective type courses, or, you know, that, you know, the overall, the, you know, the lack of a correct answer, you know, in, you know, any of these humanities based courses just really kind of left me unsatisfied. You know, the fact that anybody could come along and, claim whatever the hell they wanted, you know, whatever theory or you know, about, you know, political systems or about, you know, why socialism works well or why it's, you know, the worst thing on, you know, in human history. You know, you can argue either side, you know, in a very, you know, what's deemed a very legitimate way. And, you know, and really there's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. And that's true. I mean, that's how the world works. But it really, you know, that lack of a right answer, you know, sort of left me, you know, wanting more.
Yeah, it's unsatisfying. And they're untestable anyway. So
yes,
you can kind of just, yeah, you just feel like you're going in circles a little bit. So how did the music lead you back into programming then?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I really don't know. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it felt like, but it really felt like the more I became interested in music and in trying to understand, you know, why do we have this, you know, the major scale, you know, and why do we have, you know, how did we settle on 12 notes, you know, and 12 notes in an octave, and how is it that octaves are even a thing, you know, and you know, once you kind of dive in a little bit and realize that, you know, that there are these harmonics that are sort of behind, you know, behind music and you know, and you know, and audio frequencies, you know, tend to, you know, double, you know, with each octave. I think that's correct anyway. But you know, that there's some real, you know, there's real math that sort of describes, you know, and sort of helps define what, you know, what makes, you know, something sound pleasant to a human. You know, it was, but to me that part was fascinating. And again, it sort of felt like, you know, there was a hint of, you know, there was a right answer. You know, it wasn't, right. I mean, obviously, you know, people like different kinds of music and, you know, people even like different types of performances, you know, but just the fact that everything that people were playing had this sort of basis in mathematics and in physics, for me, it was very satisfying in a way that, you know, that these humanities-based courses just weren't, you know, for so long. And so that was sort of the first inkling that, you know, maybe I should sort of go, you know, find my way back around to, you know, things where there's more of a right answer or there's a, you know, a generally agreed upon sort of correct answer. That's as far as I can tell, you know.
That's interesting. You know, I know a little bit about music, but I never got into it that much. But the interplay between music and mathematics has always fascinated me, because it music is such a natural thing, and once you understand that there's all of this crazy math behind it, that kind of just came out naturally. Like, I don't think people discovered chords necessarily by doing the math to figure them out.
Right,
but the fact that the math fell out of it it fascinates me.
Right, exactly, and that there is this backing that, you know, backing this sort of foundation in mathematics was, yeah, that sort of helped explain, or, you know, well, as far as we can tell today, anyway, you know, it kind of helps explains what, you know, what types of tones sound pleasant to a human ear and what ones don't.
Right, yeah, you can have like a discordant sound that makes you feel off edge.
Exactly.
Uneasy.
Yeah, and. Yeah. Yeah, and there are scales and you know, modes that you can play in, and you know, and there is, you know, in music there almost is kind of a right answer and a wrong answer, right? That you know, if you wanna give somebody a feeling of tension or of sadness, you know, you play minor chords or you play sort of diminished chords or, you know, these diminished scales or things like that. And you know, it's almost like kind of seeing through the matrix, right? You know, there's this you know, there's music, and some of it sounds good and some of it sounds bad, but behind all of it, there's physics and math, you know, and that was very satisfying, you know, in a way that other things hadn't been up until then.
Yeah, no, I can see that. So you started taking computer classes?
So eventually, you know, it was around that time that I sort of realized that was the part that was missing, was this kind of a lack of a, you know, the fact that everybody could be right or that everybody could be wrong in, you know, in some of these other courses. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure this sounds like just alien to, you know, to some of your listeners, but, you know, there are some of us who are wired up this way, I guess.
I think pretty much everybody out there feels that they are right all the time. Don't worry about it.
Well, I know I'm right. So, yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, me too. See, we're both right.
Exactly.
Problem solved.
So I started taking more, you know, I took a couple of music theory courses and, you know, kind of enjoyed those and continued playing guitar, although, you know, never did anything, you know, worth note, you know, with it, but it was just kind of a fun, you know, hobby. But then eventually I sort of came back around and I thought, well, why not? I had some friends who, you know, who were complaining about, you know, one of their, you know, data structures courses or their, you know, algorithms courses. And, you know, they're describing how, you know, how sorting works or something like that. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I just felt like that was something that was very interesting to me. That was something that I wanted to, you know, kind of dive in and, you know, sort of learn how, you know, how these algorithms work. And the fact that these algorithms can be applied to, you know, any computing system was just fascinating. You know, it wasn't that, you know, on an Apple II, you must always use, you know, bubble sort because, you know, I guess I don't even know what I was thinking, but, you know, the fact that you could really separate, you know, algorithms and a lot of the, you know, computer, you know, the computer theory from the actual system you were running on, you know, was also like very interesting.
The science side of things is something versus the engineering side of things. So it like sort of the greater truth of computer science kind of just interested you as a pure entity.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, I didn't go apeshit with it. And, you know, it's not like I was, you know, real interested in, you know, DFAs and NFAs and, you know, all of the, you know, computer theory can, you know, right. can kind of go off in, you know, in some, I mean, you know, it can kind of go off the deep end too, but, yeah. you know, but overall, you know, just the fact that there, you know, that there was this body of work that was done, you know, to sort of, you know, show that, you know, here are how you solve certain types of problems, regardless of the system that you're on, you know, was right. sort of the yeah. first thing that kind of caught my attention and kind of sucked me in. And, you know, and then it was, you know, so then I took some, you know, some algorithms and data structures courses and by then I was kind of, you know, right back into it. You know, it was sort of, mm-hmm. you know, it became the thing that I, you know, thought about while I was taking a shower, you know, or, right. you know, maybe, you know, if I got something wrong or if I, you know, screwed something up, I really wanted to understand why and kind of, you know, learn more about, you know, I was just generally interested in it at that point in a way that I hadn't been interested in anything at university up until that point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was kind of by then. You know, and this was, you know, sadly, this was, you know, I think, you know, the end of my second year in college, you know, I had, you know, taken, you know, kind of my first undergrad course, you know, in computer science. And so I had a lot of catching up to do. I had to move fast to, you know, to fit in all the coursework and graduate, you know, in a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so you graduated with a comp sci degree?
Yes. So I had a comp sci degree. I didn't get it in 4 years. It took me, I think, 4 years and, you know, 2 quarters, you know, something like that. But,
well,
you know,
that's not bad with it. Yeah. With a 2 year. Right. Yeah. So,
yeah, that's true. And it was pretty, I mean, I had kind of put myself through hell. I was sort of by my fourth year, I was ready to be out of college. I just wanted to get out and work.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. I bet. So did you join Apple straight out of college?
So, yeah, I mean, I had applied for a couple of jobs and, didn't get them, you know, in hindsight, it's great. You know, one of them was working for Amdahl, which was sort of a, you know, big mainframe company. I believe they were in Scotts Valley and a couple of other jobs, but then eventually I joined this, you know, it was, you know, I think it was like midsummer or early summer, you know, after I had graduated and I was, you know, staying up here, moving back home was not an option. You know, I wasn't giving myself that option yet. And so after applying for a couple of positions and not getting them, I went and joined this contract place called Oxford and Associates, which, you know, at the time, you know, I had heard that they had some ties to Apple, you know, that a lot of people mm-hmm. who were contractors at Oxford tended to go on to have contracts at Apple. So
is that the same one our mutual friend Juckett was at?
I wonder,
because he did something similar. He had a contracting gig doing QA, I believe.
Okay.
At Apple.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Oxford was kind of a big, it was sort of a big feeder into Apple at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
I'll check with him. I'll check with him after. But yeah, like he has, it's the same story or at least very similar. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I got a job with Oxford, you know, through Oxford, contracting to Apple's developer tech support group. And so I started in DTS. I had worked, you know, under contract for 6 months with Oxford, and then a full-time position opened up at Apple, and I applied for it and, you know, got the full-time DTS job.
How was that? That's an interesting job to get out of, you know, right out of school, because I think school, you take, not to sound reductive, but it's a more scholarly approach, right? And when you get into the deep end of QA and all of that, that's a very nuts and bolts sort of end of the spectrum. Was that a bit of an adjustment for you?
Yeah, it was an adjustment, but it was, but in some ways, it was exactly what I had wanted. I mean, it was, DTS. I can't recommend it highly enough. I can't recommend it enough. I mean, it was, in some ways. I mean, in a lot of ways, I was paid to learn. You know, I mean, it was, you know, now I was getting, you know, gosh, I don't even remember. It was like $20 an hour or something like that. You know, I was getting paid $20 an hour, which I had never been paid that much before. You know, it was like well over twice as much what I had made up, you know, before that. And I got to learn about Macintosh programming, you know. So I was getting paid what I thought was a stupid amount of money at the time, you know, to learn. And previously I had been learning this stuff, you know, in university, and I had to pay, right? You know, I had to pay tuition to learn this, you know, and the stuff that I was learning, by the way, wasn't, you know, anywhere near as interesting as, you know, once I got into Apple, and, you know, developer questions would come in, and, you know, and when I got there, I mean, I certainly wasn't, you know, I hadn't ever, you know, written anything to, you know, against the Macintosh toolbox by the time I had gotten into DTS. And so it was, you know, a lot of the, you know, kind of the first 3 months was just, you know, figuring out, you know, generally where am I interested in, and then, you know, and then sort of latching on to, you know, the smartest people in DTS who, you know, happen to be, I mean, just brilliant people on their own. And, you know, it takes a special kind of talent, I think, to, you know, it's almost cliche now, but, you know, when a developer kind of writes in, you know, or when anybody asks a question like on Stack Overflow or things like that, sort of the cliched response is, what are you really trying to do? You know,
right.
Because, you know, a lot of times you get these just nutso questions, and it's kind of a, huh? Yeah. You want to do what?
Right. The question itself is like, no, you were, yeah. Like, I don't know. How do I ride my bicycle along the train tracks? Like, no, don't, please don't. Just, where are you trying to go? I'll give you directions.
Exactly. It's sort of, yeah, you know, I want to use QuickDraw, but, you know, I want to use it at interrupt time, you know, and it almost works well, but not quite. How can I make it work all the time? You know, and it was,
right.
Oh my God, what you're trying to, you know, and so for at the beginning, it was kind of, well, what is interrupt time? And how does that, you know, work into, right. You know, how the Macintosh, you know, the toolbox works, you know, and, you know, so every single question that I got was just an opportunity to go and just pour over inside Mac, you know, pour over sample code, go and talk to the really smart people who were in DTS, who knew this stuff backwards and forwards. But, you know, thank goodness now, you know, they weren't going to give me the answer, right? They were teaching me to fish. You know, they weren't going to give me the fish, but they were going to say, you know, have you looked at inside Mac memory in the, you know, look at the, you know, set.
Yeah, that's great. Remember, yeah,
you know.
Oh, so yeah, because obviously, man. Interrupt
yeah,
time
you know,
is
they
special. Yeah, and you don't know necessarily why interrupt time is special until you've actually, you know, understood how the system works.
Exactly. And people were very good about, you know, they're going to spoon feed you just enough to make it so that you know where to look, but then it's really on you to go look and sort of do the deep learning. And
that's
so,
great.
Yeah, I mean, it was. You know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm going to drop a name here, but, you know, or maybe a couple names, but, you know, one of the people who I worked with quite a bit was Jim Luther, who was in DTS for a long time. he wrote More Files. I'm not sure if you had ever used that.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, you know, he was that, you know, he came from the Apple II. A lot of these guys had come from the Apple II, and, you know, it was sort of right after the, you know, there, I could tell that there was a little bit of resentment between, you know, the people who were on the Mac who felt like, you know, this is God's computer and this is, you know, the way of the future, and throw all those sticks and stones called the Apple II away, you know, and the Apple II people were saying, yeah, well, we're keeping the lights on over here. You know, what have you done? You know, how much does that thing cost again? You know, and how much RAM do you have in that? You know, it was, you know, there was definitely a little bit of back and forth, you know, it was, and then it's, you know, kind of started settling down by the time I got there. But yeah, it was just, I mean, it was a phenomenal environment.
Yeah. So they were selling Apple IIs way later than people expect. I think they stopped in the late 90s, late 80s, maybe early 90s. I don't know.
I think I was still there. I believe they stopped selling the Apple II in 93 or maybe even 1994.
That's a little bit bananas.
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nuts. And I think even after they stopped selling the Apple II, you could get, you know, the Apple II, you know, the LC card, you know, for a while as well.
Right. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you some more about Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/debug and enter offer code debug at checkout. A better web starts with your website. So if you are considering making a website, if you are considering asking a friend to help you make a website, if a friend asks you to make a website, I would like you to please consider Squarespace. It is perhaps the most hassle-free, the easiest, and the safest bet I've ever seen to create a website of your very own, or to recommend to someone else to create a website of their very own. If you're anything like me, then you end up becoming the de facto tech support for everyone in your local family and group of friends. And they will inevitably come to you at some point and say, hey, I've got this really great idea. I've got this business. I've got this hobby. And I need a website for it. I want a website for it. It's for a team. It's for an event. It's for something. It's for another. And all they need is a website. And that usually means they want you to make it and support it for them. And that, you know, there lies danger in that path. But the nice thing about Squarespace is if you do know HTML, if you do know CSS, you can go nuts. You can make anything you want to make. But if not, they have beautiful templates created by designers. Simple and easy. Drag and drop. They are responsive. They look great on phones, on tablets, on PCs, on Macs, on mythical television 10-foot interface designs. They even have 24/7 support so that they can call Squarespace instead of calling you, or you can call Squarespace instead of calling your friends. Plans start at just $8 a month. They include a free domain name if you sign up for a year, and they even include an e-commerce store, your very own web store. So if you have a product you want to sell, if you have a great t-shirt you want made, if you have a mug you think is hilariously funny, if you have anything that you want to just sell, you don't have to go find some other provider, merchant cards, whatever, to get it done. It's all there. It's all available for you right in Squarespace. You can start a trial. Best of all, no credit card is required. All you do is start building your website. If you decide you love Squarespace as much as I think you will, all you do is go to squarespace.com/debug. You use offer code debug. You get 10% off your first purchase, and you get to show some support for the show. I want to thank Squarespace for their support. I want to thank you for supporting them because they're supporting us. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website.
So how did you sort of, obviously your skills grew at DTS, and then you wanted to start writing your own apps, or like get into a different group, or like how did that progress?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'd started doing, you know, other than, you know, sort of building up my own body of, you know, sample code and kind of, you know, tips and tricks and, you know, and how to figure out developer problems, you know, It took a while. I was in DTS probably for, you know, a little over, including the contract time, I think I was in DTS for about 2 years. So I was from the, you know, end of 1992 until, you know, the end of 94, I think is when, you know, was when I left DTS and went into Mac System Software. But during that time, it was, you know, I went from, you know, kind of, you know, asking all these people who are way smarter than me, you know, how do you, you know, where should I look for this? Or what's, you know, what could be going on here? Or here's the answer I'm about to give. Is that really, you know, all the, you know, the whole story? Or, you know, what more should I, you know, pass on to, you know, start, I started picking up, you know, new technologies that were being introduced as well, you know. And so one of them was this thing called the drag manager, or drag and drop.
It's System 7, right? Introduced that?
Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah. I mean, it came out between System 7 and 7.5. I think it came out after System 7.1. Yeah. I mean, it was rolled into 7.5, but I think it came out as an extension that you could install on 7.1 or later. And there just weren't that many apps out there. I mean, obviously it was brand new technology. There wasn't that much that showed how to use this thing. And I'd always kind of liked, you know, in addition to writing kind of the, you know, the sample code that would go out to developers and things like that, you know, I really sort of, you know, the few times that I had played with a Next machine up until then, you know, I really liked the dock. You know, I thought the dock was just the coolest thing. And, you know, and I couldn't understand why there wasn't a dock for the Mac. Like, you know, how many years ago did, you know, this dock-like thing come out, you know, for Next boxes? And it was so cool, but, you know, we didn't have one for the Mac. And so with drag and drop, that was sort of, you know, it was kind of an opportunity to, you know, to kind of use this now built-in, you know, system technology to kind of support, you know, either, you know, drag and dropping, you know, icons or applications, you know, documents or applications from the Finder, you know, into something like a dock and using that as kind of a quick launcher. And
that's
so
cool. Wait, could it do text snippets at the time, at the beginning?
Yeah, it did. You could do text snippets as well. I mean, it had different flavors, they called them, you know, for contents.
So that's cool. So you did a dock that like a
I did a dock
object. Yeah.
Exactly. I did a little, you know, it was a little shareware app. It was called Malph, M-A-L-P-H. And it was a little, you know, it started as just sort of postcardware. You know, if you got this thing, you know, if you downloaded this thing and you like it, just send me a postcard. Here's my address. You know, no paying or anything like that. I was just more curious, like, to see, you know, who was going to send me postcards, right?
Yeah. Oh, those were the days. How great was that?
It was awesome.
I never did that, but I just love the idea of just send me a postcard.
And for a while, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I got a bunch. It was phenomenal. I mean, I got postcards from, you know, Finland and Germany and, you know, just you know, did I get any? I definitely got some from Japan. I got a number from Japan. You know, obviously the U.S., I think from, you know, Canada, I got quite a few, it was really cool. Yeah. I mean, I loved it. You know, you get this postcard, it's just kind of a fun, you know, it's a little, you know, just a little acknowledgement that, hey, you know, I used that thing that you made, you know?
It's almost like a more warm and fuzzy thing than getting paid.
Right.
I mean, not that getting paid is bad, but, you know, somebody took the time to go out and send you a postcard, which is nice.
Right. You know, and now looking back, I mean, with the internet and everything, it feels so, you know, quaint in some ways. Right. You know, but it was, you know, that was another one of those experiences, you know, just creating this dock and, you know, coming out with 1.0 and it was kind of shitty, but, you know, building on it and, you know, coming out with 1.1, 1.5, just kind of the incremental development process and, you know, what should I work on now? And what are the things that it's never going to do because I don't think that they're important, you know, you know, and fending off, you know, all the feature requests, right? You know, it's sort of the, you know, people want it to be something different from what you want it to be, you know, and you know, you got to go ahead.
It's the truth of having a real product rather than you can program whatever you want, but when you've got a product, you need to make all of these sort of meta decisions about the actual development.
Right. Right, exactly. And it's very helpful if you have, you know, sort of, you know, a strong, you know, strong opinions yourself or a strong kind of, you know, guiding principle, you know, as far as, you know, this thing, you know, I didn't create this thing to become a Finder replacement. So everybody who sent me, you know, feature requests that, you know, were sort of replacing things that you could do in the Finder, you know, well, that's not really what it is. So, you know, is this something that I will personally, you know, find useful? Well, and I think that was the other part of it too, was, you know, by accepting postcards, you know, instead of payment, it was very, you know, it was liberating in a way as well, because it meant that, you know, I can do exactly what I want and you can either use it And that's lovely. And I'd love that you do use it. Or if you don't use it, you know, I'm not going to feel like I ripped you off, you know, or that you right. got something, you paid for something that wasn't what you expected. You know, it was.
Yeah. You're not beholden to your customers, right? Like you know, come and go. If you like it, that's perfect. If not, well, that's fine. That's interesting that you did, like, so did you define what you wanted it to be ahead of time, or did it just kind of grow out, like, as you got a suggestion, you're like, nope, doesn't fit, and sort of through the rejection come to discover what you wanted the application to be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it was really closer to the latter. I mean, it was really, you know, sort of initially when I wrote this thing, it was to learn about drag and drop and to have a dock that, you know, that I liked using, right? It was kind of, I'm scratching my own itch here, and maybe other people right. will find it useful. And, you know, if I really want a dock, maybe other people do too. And, you know, here it is, and knock yourselves out. And it was really, I think it was over time, you know, getting kind of feature requests or getting feedback that, hey, I really, you know, I'd love to use it, but, you know, it doesn't play. I mean, the most absurd, you know, example that I always used was, well, I can't play QuickTime movies in, you know, in a dock tile, you know, and it was sort of the, well, it will never do that. I will never, ever add that to this product. So if that's what you're looking for, maybe you should.
Yeah,
move
I guess. On. Yeah. Didn't they demo that in 2001 with the OS X launch?
Oh, yeah. That's a
they
good
They minimized
point.
A QuickTime movie into the dock.
So, yeah. So,
so you, know, got Sherlock, people... buddy.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, I got Sherlock.
Yeah, so maybe those people are finally happy.
it really was a, you know, it really was sort of an organic thing or something that kind of developed over time. And it was sort of, you know, initially, you know, you get a feature request and you're kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool. Or you go, you know, yeah, not really. You know, I want to make you happy, but I really don't want to. I'm not going to add that. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, and over time, you can see sort of the pattern in, you know, the types of things that you want to add because you find them interesting or you think it's going to make a better product, and the types of things you don't. And sort of based on that, you can kind of create a structure, you know, that you can help to use to, you know, decide whether things are going to come later. But it really, you know, it wasn't anything like these. You know, I'm not sure if you've heard of like these, you know, these Steve Jobs stories where, you know, before we went and bought a washer, we sat down and thought about, you know, the washerness, the washerness of a washer.
The purpose of a washer.
Yeah. It was a lot more organic than that. Right. You know, I didn't have a mission statement or any of this other, you know, stuff. It was all just sort of, you know, what do I want to do and what, you know, what makes me happy with this product?
Right. But I mean, it develops a set of skills that I imagine will come in useful further along the story.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. But meanwhile, yeah. So go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, you're in System 7 group, right? The system group.
Yes. So then eventually, I'd moved over to the system software team. I believe the first release I worked on was 7.5.3. You know, and at that point, the system software team was really, I mean, it was, you know, I believe its official name was the, oh gosh, what was it? It was like release engineering or maintenance engineering or something like that. I mean, it was, you know, just sort of in the name was sort of baked the fact that, like, we're just doing this thing to keep the lights on for now. You know, we're keeping the System 7 thing running, but the guys over in building two, the people over in building two, they're working on, you know, the shit hot thing that you're all going to want later, you know.
Just the Copeland group, right?
Exactly. The Copeland. So it was a very small team, you know, and it was, you know, it was a very small team of generalists. And, you know, and on any given day, you could one day you could work on, you know, the virtual memory system, or you could, you know, and maybe even in the same day, you could work on quick draw cursor handling, you know.
That's kind of cool. I mean, that's up and down the entire spectrum there.
Exactly. And again, I mean, that was another one, you know, just like DTS. I mean, I'm, you know, I feel very fortunate to have been, you know, part of a group like that because, yeah, you know, like you said, you get to, you know, you can just kind of jump around and work on, you know, all different kinds of you know, technologies and kind of learn how, you know, at least a little bit how, you know, how they work before you kind of stumble through and, you know, try to get a fix in for performas or, you know, whatever the hell, you know, we had to do at the time.
So how long were you there? Because, so this is what, 94 or 5, I guess, right?
Yeah. So that was...
Things are kind of becoming a bit of a bummer at Apple at the time.
things had already had started. I had sort of, you know, learned, you know, that things were kind of already a bummer by the time I took a full-time position in, I took my full-time position in April of 93 in DTS. And I think 6 months later they had, you know, Apple had their first just major layoffs. And so I was just, you know, shitting myself because it was just, well, I've only been here 6 months, you know, right. I'm the, you know, low man on the totem pole. You know, of course I'm going to get laid off. I would lay me off, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, already, you know, there was evidence that things were not going great for Apple, but you're right. Things had just gotten, you know, from the time I had joined in, you know, I think it was late 94, early 95, you know, I think about a year later was when Copeland started sort of collapsing on its, you know, kind of on its own, around 1996.
So, yeah, and it was all bad. Maybe it's been like 20 years, but maybe this is poorly political. Was there some feeling of vindication from your group that the Copeland guys collapsed after having been given all the love and you guys were renamed maintenance engineering, basically? you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't want to go negative on anything, but it's. I could see myself feeling that.
There was some feeling like that. I mean, I always tried to, I don't know. I never, yes, to answer your question, yes, absolutely there was. There was. Right. It was sort of, you know, all the stories that you know, we had been hearing about, you know, and we had been, you know, as release engineer, you know, we were, you know, we had been involved, you know, in very, you know, in very mild ways, you know, kind of, you know, doing API reviews and things like that of different components that were going to go into Copeland. And so, there had already been, you know, and engineers kind of can be an opinionated bunch anyway, as you may have heard. So, you know, there was definitely some of the, like, you know, what the hell are these Copeland guys thinking, you know, and, you know, and especially when you see an API come by and, you know, I very vividly remember, you know, looking at some file system APIs, and I was reviewing them for, you know, for the Copeland file system team. Actually, Jim Luther and I had been, reviewing them. Jim was just God of the file manager, and he later became God of VM. You know, for Mac, for System 7 and Mac OS 8. So, I mean, he was obviously the right guy to review this. And so we were both reviewing this thing together. And I remember thinking, you know, we were kind of walking through and looking at this API, and we were just trying to figure out how to create a file. You know, that was it. It was just, and there were these APIs that, you know, were coming back, and they were just so overwrought. I mean, and they were, you know, it looked like they were written by somebody who never wanted to write an API again. You know, they wanted to create the be-all, end-all, most generalized, most abstracted, you know, API that, you know, to the point where you couldn't even figure out how to do just mundane tasks.
Right. And you know, to be fair, that was a bit of an industry-wide problem at the time. The mid-90s seemed a little bit like a lot of the stuff that Microsoft was doing was just super overwrought. People fetishized the abstraction stuff, I think, in the 90s a little bit too much.
That's interesting to hear. I never, you know, I didn't realize that there were other, you know, that this was sort of an industry-wide problem.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen the exact API you're talking about, but by and large, I find that, like, during that time period, stuff was just complicated, overly so, pretty much everywhere.
Like I'm not sure if you remember the or if you've ever seen the Apple event interface, you know, the APIs for using Apple events.
Yeah, sure.
You know, but that was sort of an example that was in my mind, you know, and forgive me if you created, you know, I think it was Kurt Pearsall and Ed Lai or somebody, you know, some people who created the Apple event API, but oh my God, what a disaster. I mean, it was just awful. I mean, you know, you had to figure out, you know, before you could send an Apple event, you had to create an AE descriptor, and you had to add an AE address descriptor that described the destination for this, you know, for this event that you were going to send. And, you know, and there, yeah. and there was just, I mean, there were so many, you know, so many calls that you had to make just to do just the most mundane things that it was just, I mean, it was so hard to use that, I mean, thank goodness, you know, something like AE Gizmos came along later, you know, and right. made it so yeah. that, you know, the most common things were now, you know, a couple lines of code instead of, you know, a gazillion lines. And by the way, you better check your error codes, you know, on the out, you know, for each of these calls too. You know, Copeland felt like the Copeland APIs themselves felt like it was the Apple events team, you know, developing this API with even more complexity. You know, it was like the Apple event interface just kind of on steroids.
So would you say that it collapsed under its own weight?
You know, I think there was some of the, you know, of, you know, under its own weight, you know, was why it collapsed. But, you know, really, I think, you know, the biggest thing was just, you know, was just the management. I mean, I'm trying really hard here to not bash any individual person or anything like that. Right. So I'm just going to generally say the management of Copeland, you know, there were people who were in positions to make decisions, to make real decisions about, you know, the future of Copeland and managing the schedules and the deliverables, and neither of those things were done, you know. And it was almost to the point where, you know, there were, you know, again, without saying names, there were VPs of engineering who, you know, who were supporting parallel efforts on sort of alternate kernels that were not the, you know, the kernel that was slated to ship in Copeland. And so when you have things like that, it's sort of, well, do you believe your own story? You know, it's
right.
You know, it's,
well, you're running a research lab at that point, and rather than a product company.
That's right. And I think, you know, the one person I'm thinking of in particular came from, you know, a heavy research background, and I think that, you know, he knew, you know, how to spin up new projects and didn't know how to ever ship, you know, existing projects.
Sure.
So I think
there's plenty of really smart people that just don't make for great managers. I think the different skill sets, really.
Exactly. Definitely. Yeah.
So Copeland collapses in around 96. Are you still in the 7 group? You're in the systems group, but yeah. And so how did you take the next acquisition news? Did you guys know about it before the announcement or what?
Yeah, there were, you know, there were some rumors about it. You know, there was definitely, it was understood that, you know, B was one of the, you know, BOS was one of the, you know, kind of the front runners. There were also some, you know, I think in Mac hardware at the time, you know, there were some people who were pushing really hard to use the NT kernel from Microsoft as well.
Yeah, I'd heard that too. Yeah,
and
it's kind of interesting that, you know, could have been cool because it was running on PowerPC at the time.
Yeah, right. It could have been cool. I mean, I guess in hindsight, you know, looking at things like, you know, power management or, you know, security or things like that, you know, I would not want to have, you know, kind of the Windows XP story. You know, around security.
I'm not saying that I think the road that was taken was probably the best road to take, but I don't think it's bananas to consider the NT kernel as a basis for the next Mac. You know, I think it was basically prudent, like a prudent idea to talk to them about it.
I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it was good that, you know, people were open-minded and were considering all options. I had sort of at the time, you know, I had played with BOS a little bit, but, you know, it seemed like there were some pretty big holes there. And it really felt like there was more sizzle than steak, you know. And so, you know,
like you could attach a Mac video onto a cube, but you couldn't print, really.
Exactly.
or
there was no real, as far as I can tell, no internationalization story, no localization story, you know, or multiple users.
Exactly. Single user too. So, interesting, but ultimately probably not what you want to build on for the next 20 years.
Right. You know, and the other thing I think too is that, you know, at that time it was very sort of, you know, one of the things that was sort of sexy about BOS was the idea that they had this fully threaded toolbox, you know, and, you know, and nothing else, as far as I can tell, nothing else had, you know, a fully threaded toolbox. It was sort of, no, it's single threaded. You can have other, you know, threads running in the background, worker threads doing, you know, worker thread things, but, you know, you should never, you know, render into, you know, into a frame with, you know, two threads or, you know, or have one window per thread. Or so I think that was part of what was appealing. But ultimately, you know, I'm glad that Apple made the choice, obviously.
Also had a C++ API, which at the time was exciting, but which kind of the fragile base class thing screwed them a little bit after.
That, gosh, that's right. I forgot about fragile base class problem. I mean, even early versions, I think, of IOKit had, you know, the fragile base class problem too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyway, yeah. Bummer. So how did things get shaken up after that acquisition? From your perspective, I guess.
So to go back just a little bit, you know, one of the things that had happened was, you know, as soon as Copeland had sort of collapsed, there was, you know, all of a sudden, you know, kind of, you know, a lot of the focus of, you know, around shipping and you know, shipping out to customers sort of came back to, you know, the release engineering team, because we had been shipping on a pretty consistent basis. We had, you know, we had regular updates and we had, you know, I mean, there were, you know, each release was in my mind anyway, it was tangibly better. I mean, it was easy to see that it was a distinct improvement over, you know, the previous release. So, you know, in other words, System 7.5.5 had, you know, a bunch of VM work that was, you know, that was done for it. And, you know, and one of the things that I had been working on was, we had these native libraries, PowerPC native libraries, but, you know, if we didn't use the version that was, you know, in the ROM, then it was, okay, forget it. Let's try to patch it as best as we can or things like that. And hope we don't have too many mixed mode switches and, you know, and things like it. We had sort of been creating a little bit of a mess, you know, kind of, you know, along the way. And so, you know, one of the things that was getting teased apart and was getting improved with, you know, first with, I think, 7.6, System 7.6, and then later 8.0 and, you know, 8.5 and things like that were, you know, the introduction of more native libraries. And, you know, and it's hard because, you know, you think, well, of course, yeah, just compile a native library. That's a makefile fix, you know. you want to run native quickdraw on that box, you know, add native quickdraw target to, you know, that particular box and in it goes. Sure. And what's your next job?
Easy as pie.
Exactly. Easy as pie. But it was never, you know, unfortunately, because there were all these different, you know, ROMs that we had been shipping and there was this strong desire. Yeah. I mean, you know, memory was still very limited. Right. And so, you know, there was a strong desire to use as much of, you know, the code that was in the ROM as we possibly could if, you know, if it was working. So we really had kind of this mixed system where, you know, we had, you know, the ROM that was, you know, loaded and you know, initialized and was being used. But then on top of that, we would have these native library overrides, you know, and ways of kind of overriding the, you know, the ROM functionality once we had decided that it was suboptimal or buggy or what have you. And so, you know, kind of over time, you know, 7.5.5, 7.6, 8.0 was getting better and better. By the time, you know, 7.6 came around, or shortly after 7.6, Copeland had kind of collapsed, and a lot of the focus around shipping, you know, was kind of, you know, switched way, you know, back to pretty much, you know, one of the only teams that was shipping software at Apple, you know, which was our group. And so all of a sudden we went from, you know, this small kind of ragtag team, you know, that wanted to, you know, was just trying to, you know, keep the Mac limping along until this great new OS comes along, to, no, we were the story. You know, we were the thing that was going to be, you know, the basis for, you know, what would become Mac OS 8 and then 8.5 and 9.0. Right. And so a lot of Copeland technologies kind of came back to Mac OS because of that. You know, things like navigation services and appearance manager and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, like the look of Mac OS 8 was, you know, basically cropped from Copeland effectively.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
I always kind of felt like, so I joined the Mac thing. Like I bought my first Mac in about 96, so I came in for OS 8 or maybe 97. Basically, as soon as Next got acquired, I'm like, okay, I want buying a Mac. But I always kind of felt that like System 7, the point releases could have, I mean, I think System 7 was held back a bit because they decided that Copeland was going to be 8.
Yes.
So they could never bump the number high enough to actually make the improvements that were happening in System 7 commensurate with like the effort and the improvements of, you know, the scale of them.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, that was absolutely the case. I wish I could remember some more specific examples, but there were a lot of times where, you know, when, you know, the release engineering team wanted to do something like, what would be an example? Something like keychain, you know, let's say, you know, the keychain functionality that was in, you know, I think it was first in the PowerTalk release of, you know, System 7, you know, and so we had decided, all right, we want to do this keychain thing. And forgive me, keychain may not be the absolute correct example of this, but you know, the answer we would get back from product marketing was, well, no, we're not going to add any more, you know, new features and functionality to you know, kind of the System 7 line. That's all going into Copeland. So, you know, you need to really just go back to release engineering and just keep this thing basically limping along. You know, I know that I talked to a bunch of friends, you know, thank goodness I'm still friendly with a lot of the people who were, you know, on that release engineering team. And, you know, and a lot of them are still, you know, kind of hold a grudge against, you know, product marketing or, you know, screwed up management or whatever at that time. And like, you never let us do the great stuff that we could on, you know, System 7, because you wanted it all to go into Copeland and Copeland sucked and, you know, sure. You know, and therefore you're stupid and, you know, what? And I don't know, it never felt that way. I kind of felt like, well, if I was running a company, and if I was really, you know, placing all my, you know, eggs in, you know, in this, you know, new basket over here, like, I'm going to want to, I don't want any of the eggs to go anywhere else. I mean, it really, it made sense to me. I didn't really resent, you know, product marketing or management or anybody like that for, you know, effectively holding back System 7 to make, you know, your next OS release great. Because the next OS release is really the your future. And why do you want to compromise your future just because you can do something today?
Right, like, not irrational decision-making.
Right.
You can see why you'd make that decision. It may not be in your favor particularly, but that doesn't make it irrational or crazy or, like, bullheaded or anything.
Right.
So how was OS 8? Because that one interests me. Because that, I think that started after the Next acquisition, right? Like, the actual OS 8 that shipped. So, you know, you've got... So I think initially they said that they would have Rhapsody out within a year or something, which is why I bought my Mac. That turns out not the case. but that must have been an interesting product because it was really like, okay, now you guys have to go and make something fancy. But you know that you're effectively going to be end of life with Rhapsody coming out pretty soon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, OS 8, to me, the thing that I remember about OS 8 was, you know, was that we you know, there was a lot of work that was put in to kind of, you know, kind of take the most viable parts of Copeland, you know, that had been developed already, you know, and some of them were things like the high-level toolbox and, you know, some of the appearance manager work and things like that. And kind of bring those back to System 7, you know, to a System 7 foundation, which in some ways is effectively, it's an embedded operating system. I mean, whether we want to, you know, by today's terms, that's an embedded OS.
Just for anybody listening, it's effectively the operating system loads up into VAM, and the applications are effectively plugins. Like all of the address space is shared. You can poke at other people's stuff. It's very much a very lightweight operating system by today's standards.
Yes. Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to lay the groundwork by what. Yeah. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. No. So pulling it back from Copeland into the 7 branch to create 8, was that a big hurdle, or were the APIs kind of similar enough? Like, was the underlying structure close that you could do it?
It was a big hurdle, mostly in that it was, you know, we had a lot more sort of, you know, native, you know, one of the biggest things that went into Mac OS 8 was a lot of the native toolbox pieces, you know, like a native control manager, native window manager. You know, the team at the time was, I believe it was managed by a guy named Ed Vos, who's still, you know, today. You know, I had hired him back later. You know, we'll get to that, you know, years and years later. He's still in the iOS org right now. But Ed and his team had, you know, a lot of these components that they were fully, you know, native, you know, rewritten in C, just new implementations of control manager, you know, dialogue mm-hmm. manager, window manager, you know, all the kind of the traditional kind of UI toolbox managers that were there, but they happened to also plug into this new thing called the appearance manager. And now that I'm talking about it, I'm sure I'm getting some of the details wrong, because I think a lot of those things actually ended up in 8.5. Around 8.0 was the, yes, please forgive me. This is, for anybody who's listening, this, for me, this feels like a memory test. Fail horribly, so
getting details wrong is part of the charm of the show. Don't worry about it.
awesome. Yeah. Then I will make it very charming. but there was, you know, so there were a lot of components that were starting to come in Mac OS 8 that you know, by the time we got to 8.5, we had a lot of these native libraries, and you know, and the underpinnings of Mac OS were still the same, right? I mean, it was still, you know, we had a VM and it worked a lot better than it did in, you know, sort of, you know, before System 7.5.5, but it was mm-hmm. still, you know, kind of a VM that had to operate on, you know, a single address space for all applications. You know, so if you had an app that, you know, where you just, you know, wanted to use way more RAM than the user expected, you had to bring up get info and type in a new value for how much RAM you type in a new magic number for how much RAM to use. You know, it was, you know, for considering this thing was a Mac, we thought it was always, you know, funny internally. You know, we thought it was funny that, oh my God, here's this thing that we've worked so hard to make user friendly, and now we're making this poor user go and type in, you know, 4096 into a size resource or, you know, into the get info panel. You know, poor users.
Yeah. And again, what the Mac called a VM is not what you'd see in a comp sci class. Like, you're getting very, very different beast.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you all about usertesting.com. Go to usertesting. We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you all about usertesting.com. Go to peak.usertesting.com. You get a free 5-minute video of a real person using your site or app. Use ExpressPass Debug to get your results back even faster. So what kind of results? What is user testing? It is a tool that lets you get videos of real users testing your mobile site or app in just a few hours. You get high quality video of the person's screen, of their hand motions, and they talk to you. They tell you what they're doing, what they're thinking, and why. It's like you get to look inside the head of someone using your website or app. It can be anything. It can be for iOS. It can be for Android. It can be for the web. It can be for app. It can be for phones. It can be for tablets. You can even test unreleased apps. All you do is upload your IPA file. They take care of everything else, the distribution, finding the users, anything that you need to take care of. This lets you get feedback before your app hits the store. It lets you see, I mean, we always have preconceptions. We always think we know every use case, but there is nothing in the world, there is no amount of preparation or QA possible that equals real users hitting your app, especially it starts to get to volume and number. They find edge cases you didn't consider. They find uses you hadn't thought of. So to get your feet wet, to try this out for yourself, User Testing has created a free version of their product. It's called Peak. Head on over to peak.usertesting.com. You get a free 5-minute video. Again, real person using your real site, your real app. And if you use ExpressPass Debug, you get your results back even faster. I want to thank usertesting.com for supporting Debug, and I want to thank you for supporting them.
So how long was the 8 project? Like a year and a bit, maybe? 18 months?
I think it was about 18 months. It was a very fast, I mean, that was sort of when I, you know, kind of got the you know, really kind of got an appreciation for shipping frequently. You know, even though we didn't talk about iteration or agile or anything like that, but it was really, you know, kind of the you know, the point of these releases, you know, until we got to 8.0, it was a little bit stretched out by then. But really it was, you know, we're trying to address, you know, customer issues as fast as we can and, you know, get releases out, get high quality releases out as frequently as we can, you know, and 8.0 stretched it a little bit, but not as much as 8.5 did later. And so even 8.0, I think, was, you know, if from what I recall, there was, I mean, there was definitely awareness of the fact that, you know, Copeland was this thing that was done. All of the focus had shifted back to release engineering as far as that was the deployment vehicle for macOS, right? That was the, until something better comes along, and we thought it was Copeland, but now we know it's not, you know, so we're going to get all of our stuff working on this System 7 foundation and keep that thing going until we, you know, get our shit together on the, you know, on the modern OS side. So even though there was that, all of that work that was taking place, while we were working on 8.0 and 8.5, I don't remember, you know, it never felt like it was, why are we doing this? It never felt like it was pointless work. It was, you know, I think that we had kind of gotten to a point where, you know, the developers that we did have were finally, you know, with Mac OS 8, you know, there was the new look and feel. And with 8.5, there were a lot of new, you know, and a lot of new libraries and new implementations, which, you know, if you have an app that's been working for years and years, and if it happens to work, you know, if you happen to get lucky and it works by side effects, you know, in some ways, you know, before 8.0, there was really this, you know, there was this feeling that we couldn't let any app break. Like we just could not, you know, no matter how wonky or strange or whatever this app was, you know, your super boomerangs or your, you know, the things that like patched out half the world, you know, oh my God, we have to keep all of this, you know, this cruft working. Otherwise people are going to go run to Windows. And especially
with a system that is as slim as macOS was, that really ties your hands. Because I mean, you can't even move the address of like a function or something. Like the data has to be in a certain place at certain times. Like it's just, it's kind of crazy.
Exactly. And so there, it was interesting. I can't really point to any one thing that happened, but somewhere between, you know, macOS 7.6 and certainly by the time we got to 8.5, I even think that it was before 8.0, there was sort of this acceptance that, okay, we want to advance the OS. And in order to advance the OS, we're going to end up breaking some of these things. So, you know, where in the past it was just like completely forbidden, like, you know, why would you even consider breaking Super Boomerang? You know, after a while, we got comfortable with, you know, having a little bit more of a, you know, kind of a vibrant, you know, kind of development, you know, vibrant development around the OS and being able to push back on a developer and saying, hey, you're really doing, you know, you've been getting lucky for years now. Maybe you should fix your crap now, you know, or if you really don't want to, then it's on you to kind of, you know, say that you're not supported in Mac OS 8. It really
was
felt...
Oh,
go ahead.
Sorry, was that something that came organically from the team, or is that like did Avi come in and sort of just dictate that, no, things are going to break?
See, and that's the thing is, I don't ever recall Avi specifically saying that. You know, you know, and when we get to Carbon, we can, you know, we can talk a lot more about that. But but there was definitely, you know, when it came time to, you know, update the toolbox, and we understood that, you know, buttons were going to look very different, and, you know, controls were going to work, you know, different than they had in the past, and maybe we're going to call these, you know, these definition procs with, you know, different things set up at different times, and it's really, you know, on the, you know, where in the past it was kind of on system software to make sure that, you know, none of that stuff breaks. Things started to loosen up a little bit, and it was possible now to go back to a developer and say, hey, we want to advance the OS. You know, we want to make this thing better. And, you know, in the process of doing that, we've noticed that, you know, you're doing, you know, a couple of things that just aren't going to work well. So please, you know, do something to go fix your app because, or fix your init or fix your system extension or whatever the hell, because we're going to break it and we're going out. And that was certainly not true, you know, earlier. I mean, there were, you know, if there were egregious cases where, you know, somebody was just doing something horribly wrong and we were going to break them, then all right, F them, you know.
Right.
But with, you know, around 8.0 and 8.5, advancing the you know, kind of the OS started to kind of come back to having equal footing with keeping the apps working, you know.
That's cool. That's interesting because that's almost a hallmark of modern Apple. I mean, not that you aggressively or that they aggressively break things, but they're not afraid to deprecate things. They're not
exactly.
afraid to move on. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think that I think some of it, you know, it some of it had started around there, and I'm not sure if that was, you know, Steve, you know, kind of coming in and saying thing. I don't think it was. I think it may have been maybe it was product marketing just kind of giving up. You know,
right.
Yeah. You know, just timing wise, I'm kind of thinking, you know, a lot of these changes happened around 1996, as far as I can recall. And I don't think that the acquisition happened until 97. So some of predated a little bit. I mean, obviously it got much stronger later, you know, and the idea of advancing the platform and making that, you know, as important as keeping the apps working was, you know, I mean, obviously, yeah, that's something that continues today, but.
Yeah, I think that's a real strength of Apple, actually. Mm-hmm. And you know, being on the outside, every now and then you get bitten, but. By and large, I think it's a terrific approach.
Yeah, I mean, and going back to Copeland, you know, one of the things about, you know, what one weird, you know, sling and poo across, you know, from the release, you know, one of the things that we would comment on is, you know, how can you possibly let product marketing say that system extensions are supposed to work on Copeland? Like, how can you build a modern right. operating system and make it so that system extensions will work? And yes, I understand you can be very clever about this and have a quote unquote trap table and, you know, detect when people are patching things and come up with this very, you know, sophisticated way of extending things and what have you. But
yeah.
really, is that really viable? You know,
and
maybe you should just push
it's a horrible
back.
Engineering solution. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever the marketing people say, that is a horrible engineering solution. Well,
yes.
I mean, what you need is a VM. You need Blue Box, basically. That's the only thing that makes any sense for that. So 8 and 9 sort of progressed pretty quickly with a lot of cool new features. And those are the classic OSs that I kind of ran while I was waiting for OS X to ship. And no, that's basically the time that I came to love Mac OS. When I first started, I was coming from OS 2. Windows NT and that kind of thing. So the fact that things would stop as I was like dragging a scroll bar up and down kind of upset me. But I came to love it and really appreciate it. When does Carbon start to happen?
Yeah. So Carbon started to happen. Oh boy, let's see. I think it was late 1997. Maybe early 1998, somewhere around there. So it was certainly, you know, the next acquisition happened, and I think the party line, you know, was still that, hey, we're going to have this thing called Rhapsody, and, you know, and you know, but our modern OS story is going to be, you know, it's all AppKit-based, if I can very generally paraphrase kind of what the message was for, you know, as far as developers go. And there was, you know, and obviously there was huge pushback from your, you know, your Adobes and your Microsofts and your Macromedias and, you know, all the big companies were just, you know, it really felt like it was, I mean, those were really kind of the dark days as well. Right. And it was,
yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, and
it's a hard
and
sell,
even,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really hard sell. And I think, you know, there were signs, you know, of you know, that Steve Jobs, you know, kind of brilliance and, you know, and things like that. But I don't think that he, you know, that Apple and even after purchasing Next, you know, that wasn't a credible story. And it was, you know, and it was going to be a very, very hard thing to push. And you know, as we all know, the developers at that time were looking to kind of, you know, I think the terms were, you know, preserve their investment in, you know, traditional Mac OS, you know, development.
Right. At the time, I was super frustrated with that because I was like a propeller head. Well, mm-hmm. I was working in games at the time, but just the idea of a cool new operating system excited me. Thinking about it now, that is a very rational position to take, given that, you know, the many, many millions of dollars that have been invested in this source code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, and you know, it's funny. I come at it from kind of the other side. You know, sort of the, you know, and it's maybe even irrational in other ways. Where, you know, yes, we've had this Mac toolbox and we can fix it up a little bit and we can make, you know, this existing Mac toolbox. We don't have to go whole hog like the, you know, like the Copeland guys did and, you know, and just make everything, you know, these overwrought APIs. You know, instead, why don't we, you know, why don't we make some of these, you know, these window records and dialog records and graph ports and stuff like that? Why don't we make those opaque and make it so that, you know, we have a little bit better idea of what developers are trying to do by having, you know, these higher level APIs and, you know, so yeah, it was, you know, there was already, you know, kind of, I mean, there were certainly people on the, you know, on the Mac OS 8 and the OS 9 side who, you know, who felt like, well, we don't need to do any of that. You know, Mach is just this, you know, horrible message passing operating system. Message passing will never be as fast as a direct function call, you know, and why are we even getting, you know, going down this road? You know, instead, what we should do is, you know, build up the, you know, that there was the nano kernel, you know, and we should take the nano kernel and make it this fully preemptive thing and, you know, get rid of all this message passing shit. And, you know, and let's just show people what we can do with, you know, putting kind of a modern kernel under Mac OS 9. You know, of course, by then, you know, I think the reality of the, you know, of the company and the way, you know, management had, you know, was making decisions was, I mean, that was just never going to be a viable thing. You know, it was, you know, but it was only kind of, you know, it was kind of a last ditch effort by sort of, you know, a bunch of the old guard to kind of keep it, keep things going.
This is when Avi was there?
And Avi was there at that
Avi
time.
Is not going to swap out Mach. Pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Exactly.
He wrote it for the listeners at home. He wrote the microkernel. That, anyway, yeah. Probably not a good bet to go against that. Yeah. Interesting, and, though.
Yeah, and I think that there was, you know, there was also, you know, I think part of the culture at that time, you know, I don't think this was, you know, this was as true on the release engineering side, but I think more, you know, more, you know, on the Copeland side, I think that there was a little bit of a, you know, sort of a distrust or, you know, not really believing kind of what the execs or the management was saying, you know.
Yeah, I can kind of understand that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, from their perspective, they were, you know, the golden team and the project fell apart and you don't really know what's happening right now. Like, I don't think it's necessarily rational, but I can definitely understand where the why the zeitgeist maybe in that group would feel that way.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So, okay, so you asked about Carbon.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was around, I think it was late 97, early 98. It was sort of, you know, there was this effort that was put into place to figure out, you know, finally, it was sort of, there was this effort that was put into place to try to figure out, okay, what are the APIs, you know, I forget what the number is, I think like 6,000 APIs in the kind of traditional Mac toolbox, maybe it was 3,000, I don't remember, but whatever that, it was many, many thousands of APIs, you know, of all of those, you know, of the APIs that were available, what are the ones that, if we were to create, you know, a Mac toolbox implementation on a modern foundation, what are the ones that we want to carry along and what are the ones we want to ditch? You know, and why, you know, and sort of, you know, let's gather some data as well, to help support whatever decisions we are making. Mm-hmm. And so it was around that time that, you know, there were discussions about, you know, creating something that I think would ultimately be called the Carbon Dater. You know, which was if you had a PowerPC native app.
Oh yeah,
it would look up, you know, all of your exported symbol, you know, all of the symbols that you need from the underlying operating system. Forgive me, and you know, and figuring out, well, okay, if you use, you know, for example, a standard file, you know, which was the old world way of picking documents or saving documents. It's you know, we just knew that, you know, that implementation was just horrible. We already had this new thing called navigation services, which was sort of the new world, you know, document picker or document saver. And
yeah,
so,
it came in mid 8, I think, right? Anyway,
yes.
Sorry, not to...
Exactly. And that was one of the, by the way, one of the things that was, you know, originally slated just for Copeland, and then once Copeland sort of collapsed, you know, it was sort of the, you know, then the effort was, hey, we really want to ship this thing. Let's ship it on this, you know, what's called Mac OS 8.
That's cool because actually 8 and 9 got a bunch of improvements that you wouldn't have expected, but it's cool that they were coming back from Copeland. Anyway, I do like the Carbon talk, so you're, Yeah. So, yeah. So you encourage people to get onto nav services, and the more of the stuff that you'd integrated from what was Copeland back into the OS 8 and OS 9 stream, I guess you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what was the impetus for Carbon? Like, did somebody say, okay, we really need Carbon on OS 10, or was Carbon originally, from your perspective, sort of sanitizing the old toolbox stuff?
Yeah. So I think a lot of the impetus was, you know, was that and you know, I wasn't in any of these meetings where I specifically heard this, but you know, the sure. feedback that I had heard, you know, sort of loud and clear was that, you know, these companies like Adobe and Microsoft and, you know, these big players were not interested in writing an Objective-C version of, you know, a new version of their app in Objective-C. That was just not going to fly for them. And even in the past when, you know, there was this thing called Copeland and, you know, and we had made, you know, it sounded like Apple had made all these promises to, you know, to these companies that, yes, your existing binaries are going to continue to work and we're going to make sure that they work really well and, you know, you don't have anything to worry about, you know, but, you know, as soon as, you know, this Rhapsody thing came in, then the story was, well, now throw out all that old shit, you know, it's time to learn Objective-C and, you know, and get on with it. And, you know, and so a lot of these companies were pushing back and saying, well, no, we're just not going to have a Mac product. You know, good luck to you, but we're going to release for, you know, OS, you know, 8 and 9 and, you know, and we're just not going to have anything for, you know, for this thing called Rhapsody. So I think a lot of the impetus was just, you know, oh my God, how can we make, you know, these big development houses, how can we make it so that they come to this new operating system that's so critical to Apple's future? And so, you know, I really credit Bertrand Serlet with, you know, really kind of pushing the idea that, you know, where in the past Apple had, you know, had really strived for binary compatibility, and we needed to keep these things like, you know, Microsoft Word 5.0 limping along on, you know, Mac OS 8.0 or things like that. You know, Bertrand was kind of the you know, as far as I can tell anyway, one of the people in a position of leadership to kind of push back and say, we're not striving for binary compatibility anymore. We are now going to strive for source compatibility or source code compatibility. And so whatever we need to do to kind of massage your sources, or whatever you need to do, developer, to massage your sources to get onto a modern foundation, you should really see this as you know, a big benefit that, you know, and at the time, you know, kind of the message that was being thrown around, and it was, you know, it sounded a little bit silly later, but, you know, the message was, you know, if you have a moderately sophisticated app, in 2 weeks with Carbon, you can have your app, that same app, running up on OS 10, you know, what would become OS 10.
I remember that slide.
And you probably now you probably roll your eyes at it, right? Like, oh, 2 weeks.
It could happen. But, you know, probably not. But it's a great objective, though. It wasn't, because Carbon was actually pretty good, and it wasn't that far away from what was considered modern classic OS stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think if you had to port Word, 2 weeks is a bit.
Yes.
In those days, just compiling Word probably took like 3 days. So 2 weeks is probably a bit short. But, you know, in general, I think Carbon was a pretty good stab at bringing people forward. And it, truth is, it worked, right?
So yeah. Exactly. It worked. And again, I think that it was the, you know, just like we had started this, you know, this kind of new dynamic around, you know, Mac OS 8 and 8.5, where, you know, we were now willing to push back on developers, right? And we were willing to say, hey, you need to go and fix your app too, or you need to fix your extension, because, you know, the boat is leaving, you know, and you're either on the boat or you're off the boat, you know, and we're not, you know, we had shifted from, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's almost a confidence thing, right? Where it's kind of a, oh no, we're going to wait as long as we need to make, you know, this effed up version of Super Boomerang limp along on Mac OS 8.5.
You really, you know, hate Super Boomerang.
I do. I really do. But mostly because I know what the, you know, the patches, you know, the traps that they
patched. Yeah.
All
yeah,
the things.
But, yeah. The thing is, the boat wasn't leaving. The boat was sinking. And when the boat is sinking, it's like, okay, you don't get to sit in the deck chair anymore. You grab a bucket. Like,
exactly.
Help us make this work.
Right.
So.
Right.
And paid off for you. And I think there's a good cultural shift.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that was one of the other things was, you know, switching from binary compatibility to source was sort of saying, I mean, it was saying that developers, this is not a free ride for you. You know, you need to pony up some effort on your side as well. If you want to get your app working on a modern operating system, and believe me, at Apple, we want you to get that thing working in the worst way, so we're going to do what we can. But make no mistake, you, developer, are going to have to put in some work. And there were people at those early WWDCs that did not like that message. You know, there were people who...
You know, you can watch the video and hear people be upset.
And I heard some of that feedback myself in, you know, in some of those sessions as well. And, you know, and it's hard to fault them, right? I mean, it's kind of, you know, I understand you've got, you know, now you've got a third operating system, you know, to kind of support or, you know, and how are you going to factor in how much, you know, effort you put into that, you know, compared to what the returns are. And, you know, it becomes very complicated. And is it really worth it after all? Like, what's this Mac thing going to do in the end? You know, why should I do any of this? You know, so I really credit, you know, Bertrand and the management at the time for having the stones to say, you know, that no, you have to, we want you to come along, but you're going to have to, you know, dig as well, you know, pick up a shovel, let's get, you know, or pick up a bucket, let's start bailing this thing out, or, you know, we're all in this together. And if you don't, then hopefully your competitors will. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. With a bit of luck, if, you know, you can play one against the other. Right. So how long were you in Carbon?
So I was in Carbon. I think it was, oh boy.
Was it its own group? Was it a cross platform group or?
I was kind of in a funny position. Yeah. Early on, it was kind of, you know, there was a small team of people, from, you know, who had come from Copeland. I mean, you know, a couple of really smart people.
Sure.
You know, one of the guys, forgive me if, you know, for name dropping, but, you know, he was my manager for a few years. And I have a huge amount of respect for him. It's a guy named John Erochi. He had come from, you know, from the Copeland side and sort of, you know, it's my understanding he was, you know, part of the kind of the due diligence and kind of the deep analysis of, you know, next step and, you know, and whether we wanted to get involved in this thing. But John, you know, he had oh gosh, a couple of people working with him. There were some people from the QuickTime team, believe it or not, because the actual original basis for Carbon was this thing called QTML, which is the QuickTime Media Library. It was sort of a portable subset of Mac Toolbox.
I did not know that. Oh, now that you mention it, I do remember that because I've used it on Windows in order to record like one of those 3D movies, like a series of frames that you can rotate around.
Oh yeah, VR, QuickTime VR.
VR, yeah, QuickTime VR thing. In order for advertising material for a game I was working on. So the game would you embedded QTML to, you know, basically create the VR. I did not know that Carbon was based around that initially, or at least used that as a seed. That's interesting. Makes a lot of sense, but I had never heard that. Yeah.
And so, you know, and around that time, that was when, you know, I had a chance to work with, you know, a couple of, you know, really, really sharp people from, you know, the QuickTime team as well. You know, and so we were taking this QTML thing, which had been, it had been ported to Windows. It had been ported to, you know, Solaris, believe it or not. It had been ported to a couple of other, gosh, I wish I could remember the other Unix-y kind of platforms where, you know, I don't think it ever shipped on any of those, but, you know, what was the SGI one? IRIX?
I was just about to guess SGI would be the IRIX, yeah.
And so QTML had, you know, it had already had support for, you know, kind of a Unix-y type system. And so it was sort of, you know, kind of a natural fit in some ways to kind of, you know, to start at least building the prototypes for what would become Carbon. And so some of the, you know, some of the very earliest prototypes that we built, in fact, to my recollection, the earliest prototype that we had built was and demoed to Steve Jobs at the time was ClarisWorks. There was, the entire works package. I mean, this is really, dating myself here. So, but anyway, yes.
What are you talking about? You're just talking about working on System 7. You're dated. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. It's a good point. Yeah. Now I'm worried about it with ClarisWorks. That's the one that I'm going to focus on.
But that's a good one because that's an honest to God application suite. You know, does real work. Pretty popular.
Exactly.
You had the source code because it's, I don't know if it was spun out of the company by that point, but whatever. You could get the code. So, yeah.
Exactly. So we had the code. It was a pretty significant body of code, obviously, right? It was very full featured and, and for the demos that we had, we did for Steve, I mean, it certainly wasn't, it wasn't something that, he could install on Rhapsody with these, with these crazy libraries and get something working. I mean, it was certainly demo-ware, but it was enough to kind of prove the point that, you could take a significant body of code and with some tweaks and with some, with some tweaks and some largely mechanical changes through the code, in other words, changing, accessing records to using getters and setters and things like that, you could have something that ran.
A little bit of elbow work, right? Yeah, you didn't need to interpret the entire project and back. You could tweak a few things here and there. So that was successful. So that's a good sign for Carbondim.
Yeah. Exactly.
We're going to take one last break, and it's not for a sponsor read. There's no money changing hands here. We're just doing a favor for a pal, for Lex Friedman. So if you're a developer who loves podcasts, the folks who sell our ads, Midroll Media, they need a director of technology, someone who would manage all the company's proprietary web apps. They need a developer who's really comfortable with Ruby on Rails, Postgres, Heroku, and even WordPress. You should love web development, feel good about your product and project management skills, and be eager to join the leaders in podcast advertising. If this is you, if you hear yourself in this, then email Lex Friedman at lex@midroll.com to learn more. Again, for more information on this role at Midroll Media, email lex@midroll.com.
Did you work with third party? Tell you what. I don't even know if you can say it.
Well,
maybe not.
I don't know if I can say either, but I'm going to say. So we were,
It's been long enough. Yeah.
We, at the time we had Macromedia in the offices and, it wasn't Director. It was one of their other, it was another just gigantic authoring system. When I hear the name, I'll remember it, But anyway, yes, Macromedia was in there, and we had, kind of our cobbled together headers, that allowed us to successfully build and run ClarisWorks. And, that was sort of the, the early basis of Carbon. And, and we'd been working with Macromedia to kind of get a port up and running. And it was one of these things that we wanted to, we wanted to get it ready, and we wanted Macromedia to get up on stage at WWDC and say, hey, we did this port and it took us, a little bit of time and, but look, now it runs here and it's the same source base that works everywhere. And unfortunately, it never quite got to that point. One of the biggest things that we ran into, believe it or not, was the case sensitive file system Rhapsody. It was all UFS based, Unix file system. And so,
I forgot about that. The first ones were all UFS.
Right.
Wow. Yeah.
And so
it's funny that comes back with iOS. But anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So that bit us pretty hard, but back at that time, just getting thing ported, and we really wanted to tell that story and have a third party tell that story too. Ultimately it was okay because, I think Greg Gilley from Adobe, I think he was managing Photoshop or, something like that at the time. He was, he was able to get up there, and I think, I don't think it was a port of Photoshop that they got up and running. I think it may have been InDesign, Adobe InDesign.
InDesign was a more modern.
Exactly.
Basis. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think Adobe was one of the companies that, you know, had a very early version of, you know, they had InDesign and, you know, and they were jazzed about this and they liked the story and, you know, they weren't pushing back, squawking too hard on the, you know, you're going to have to make changes, but hey, you want to get on it, you know, you want to get on a Model S, you got to pay, you know.
Well, InDesign also at the time was the underdog to Quark.
Yes.
And I honestly think the OS X effort from Adobe is a large part of why they just ended up eating Quark's lunch.
Yeah.
Because Quark was so slow to get onto the, you know, to, for lack of a better word, to modernize, to come to OS X.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. So, those were kind of the early, you know, other than ClarisWorks and, you know, this Macromedia app that I wish I could remember the name of, you know, InDesign was, you know, was one of the other early clients, you know, that we were able to get up and running and sort of prove, mm-hmm. you know, prove to ourselves too, that, hey, this thing is actually kind of viable.
Sure. Yeah. And so were you more at the foundational level? Because I believe Core Foundation stretches back to Carbon, right? So that got backported to the Mac OS 8 and 9 tree.
Yeah.
While so, Carbon itself was more like a HI Toolbox. Was that maybe a bit later? I'm trying to remember what the...
That was. I mean, certainly when we shipped, HI Toolbox was definitely a big part of it. So early on, kind of my early involvement with the Carbon team, you know, with John Hirochi and a couple of other people was around sort of, taking this giant body of APIs and sort of, you know, saying, are you in or are you out? You know, kind of going right. through and making the, you know, making the call on these things. And, yeah. you know, if it's you're just, in, yeah, yeah and it was just, right. And, you know, by then I had a fair amount of experience, you know, building, you know, adding new features and functionality to macOS and kind of, you know, understanding, you know, at least to some degree what, you know, what developers were using and what their expectations were. And, you know, and so what, you know, what APIs, you know, can we get rid of and developers will just kind of shrug it off versus, you know, what APIs would we get rid of and they're just going to scream, you know, and call up their marketing person and, you know, and tell us what a horrible idea this was. So, you know, that was sort of my early, you know, early involvement was on the, you know, kind of evaluating the APIs and then coming up with a plan for building this thing called CarbonLib out of headers. You know, we also added some facilities to the interface generation tool that we had within Apple that allowed you to take, you know, kind of this you know, this language that almost looked like a header file, but it was really generalized so that you could build assembly files for it or Pascal files or PowerPC or 68K, you know, and sort of extend that so that it could spit out, you know, getters and setters basically for, right. you know, some of these records that we wanted hidden. You know, and just...
Right, because that's a huge effort. I mean, and just for the audience, used to be these records and structs. Well, you're calling them records because it's Pascal lineage. Yes. But these structures used to just have all of their members exposed, and you could just read and write to them willy nilly in the code, which does not work well in terms of, you know, moving into the future. One of the big efforts in Carbon did really seem to be, you know, effectively going or taking like a more object oriented approach, where you'd have functions that would get and set this to guard, I imagine, for, you know, against people just poking random stuff, or, you know.
Right.
And so I didn't know that was automated. That's interesting.
That was actually automated. You know, I think my earliest versions, you know, it started as kind of a Perl script, but then, you know, worked with so it was automated with air quotes, you know, but but then yes, it got built, you know, sort of formalized and built into the, you know, into the tools that we use to create those headers. So later my involvement was more around the, you know, on the OS 8 and, you know, later OS 9 side, you know, building this thing called CarbonLib. So I was sort of the lead on CarbonLib for OS 8, you know, and just figuring out how this library is supposed to work. How are, you know, we knew we wanted to get rid of these things called definition procs or def procs, mm-hmm. which was a way that you could use to, within the Mac toolbox, if you wanted to, a menu, you know, a menu that looked different from sort of the traditional Macintosh menus, you had to create a definition proc that said, you know, well, no, the rectangle really is this big. And when you're trying to draw into it, you know, instead of just drawing text in, you know, Chicago 12, you know, this way, you know, draw a little grid of colors that a user could choose from, you know, things like that. And that tradition.
Almost a call, I never really looked into it that much. Is it kind of a callback system?
Well, effectively, that's what we turned it into. I mean, yes, you're right. It really was a callback system, but really it was code that was embedded in its own resource that would get these different messages for, you know, highlight item one, you know, or draw the title bar or draw the selected title bar, you know, effectively
so
based
on the message it would get. And by message, you mean basically like an int, like,
yes.
Like you get like, this is the action that's happening. And then it would do something to the graph that it was responsible for.
Exactly. And so the way that had traditionally been done on the Mac was you had to compile your own, you know, in modern terms, you had to have your own sort of sub project, you know, or a target or something like that, that built a little, you know, resource of code that the system then, you know, loaded and used for, you know, to handle the definition of, you know, the look and feel of this thing. And for Carbon, we didn't want that anymore. You know, we didn't want people to write code resources. We wanted it all just in, you know, in just a single binary executable. So what we did was just effectively create a callback system where, you know, we just had a generic code resource, a generic def proc that ran on, you know, Mac OS 8 that would just, you know, bind to your, you know, to the application's shared library and just call the routines directly from there. So if you're writing an application, you just implement these callbacks, and I mean, it was just a much nicer system, even.
Yeah, that's way nicer. Yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of, you know, trying to kind of, you know, marry the two worlds and make it so that, you know, if you did all this work, you know, we wanted to, you did all this work to kind of modernize your application code base. We wanted to make it so that it worked well on OS 9 or OS 8 or OS 9 as well. You know, as part of kind of preserving your investment in this, you know, in this code base and keeping your apps, you know, kind of working through the releases as we make this giant transition.
Right. So kind of like at DTS, this must have been a huge learning experience, because not only do you need to know all the internals of the classic OS, which you'd been working on, but you needed to quickly learn a lot about what I believe at the time he was still calling Rhapsody.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Was that like jumping into the deep end a little bit, like a brand new operating system?
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah. But it was, you know, but it was fun too. You know, it was, you know, it's always, yeah, you're right. I mean, it was an awful lot like, you know, being in DTS where you're being paid to learn, you know, and it's sort of, you know, how many chances do you get in your life to, you know, to be paid to, I mean, I guess, you know, as an engineer, you get paid to learn every day if you're, you know, if you kind of have the right attitude about it, but really, you know, whatever your attitude is, you have to learn, you know, how the existing system works and how, you know, how to make, you know, something new that works well on that as well, you know, works well on the new system. So, yeah, so there, it was a little bit of, you know, going off the deep end. I had, you know, because I went to Santa Cruz and there was, you know, a lot of the computer systems there were Unix based. You know, I had some experience with it, you know, not a huge amount. We didn't have Next Stations or Next Cubes at UC Santa Cruz, but.
Well, I don't even think they existed by that point. Maybe.
Yeah. They were there. I remember seeing them here and there late in college anyway. I remember, you know, seeing one.
So how do you, like, so what happened with Carbon? Like, you eventually you transitioned out of that group.
Yes.
A very successful project. Right.
Yeah.
Like, we would not have a Mac today without Carbon. And you know, as a guy that's basically like an app kid, OpenStep guy, or that's at least my vector into the platform. There's no denying that Carbon is really what kind of made it a viable platform for a long time. So, you know, good job. problem solved. What happens next?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I agree. I think it was critical at that time. And, you know, you can look at it technically and say, oh, well, you know, all you did was hide some symbols and expose some new symbols and, you know, covers for some of these APIs. But yes, I mean, it was, I believe that it was critical. And I think that, you know, history, you know, has sort of borne that out. So, yeah.
I mean, I think at the time I would probably have been one of those people that was holding their nose up about like, oh, it's a carbon app. But
yes,
truth is, yeah, it's a carbon app. Like, and it's Photoshop. Guess who uses Photoshop? A lot of people use Photoshop or Word or what have you, you know, even, hell, the Finder. The Finder, iTunes, yeah. That, like,
and there was definitely, you know, I agree. I mean, there were some things about it that, you know, I think that, you know, I wish that it was a little bit more integrated into the system sooner, you know, than it was or felt like it was integrated. In other words, you know, when you launched, you know, Internet Explorer, you know, which was the browser at the time for the Mac, when you launched Internet Explorer on Mac OS X, you knew you were in a carbon app. You know, you had, you know, there was the text rendered a little bit different. It was pretty ugly compared to Cocoa. You know, if you were using, you know, Office, you know, it took a little longer to launch and maybe it didn't. Well, maybe it didn't, but it was, you know, when it came up, you definitely felt like you were, it was something different than the rest of, you know, the system. And
yeah, I think it took years to get services working in them.
Right.
There was a bunch, there was a bunch of stuff that was like, hey, this is clearly a carbon app. On the other hand, these are like marquee apps that, like, if you didn't have them on your system, it'd as well be the Amiga running on a PowerPC. Like, it's kind of pointless.
Definitely, definitely. And that was, you know, and we, you know, and on the Carbon team, I think we, you know, we really held on to that. We used that to kind of, you know, keep us going too. I mean, because, you know, even at the time, it wasn't like Carbon was sort of held up as, you know, angels sing when you see a carbon app, right? It was kind of...
No, it was always sort of a necessary evil, which is kind of a downer to be on.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. You don't want to, you know, work on something that you're, you know, everybody just kind of begrudgingly accepts that, you know, well, yeah, it has to be here because things would be so much worse without it. You know, who wants to work on that? You want to work on, oh my God, this thing is fantastic, you know.
It's kind of funny. I'm just realizing that you were on the 7 team, which was kind of the necessary evil team.
Yeah.
Then you come into the Carbon. So you're an underappreciated fella, is what I'm saying.
Well, I never, yeah. Thankfully, it never really felt that way for me, but yeah, who knows what I'd be doing. But eventually, yes, I did transition over from, you know, the lead on Carbon Lib for OS 8 and, you know, to just working on in the Carbon team, working for John Urochi, who reported to Scott Forstall directly. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, and that was long before OS 10 shipped. You know, I think I made that transition in 1999, I think is when I first started working for John full time. Okay. And I was working on the core services, you know, components of Carbon. So, in particular, the file manager, resource manager, you know, kind of those low level, you know, sort of bits, some process manager in there, things like that. So the challenges there were that we really wanted to have this sort of single unified API. You know, at the time, Avi Tavanian was the VP of Mac OS development, and he was a very strong believer in heterogeneous systems and working well with, you know, fitting into you know, existing you know, sort of networks of computers and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, hence the insistence on file extensions and a bunch of other things.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, getting rid of, you know, resource forks. You know, resource forks were sort of seen as this weirdo Mac thing that no other file system had. You know, later Windows added it, but you know, to NTFS they had multiple streams, but it was even then it was kind of a bizarro thing. And
Yeah, I was two-headed. And invariably, when you try to zip something up, forget it, and everything would break anyway on all of these systems.
Right. So,
yeah. It's a nice idea. It's a really nice idea, yeah. But, you know, keeping things simple is a noble goal too.
So we kept talking for another 2 hours, and then we did another 2 hours after that, which is, to quote Guy, bananas. But it was just such interesting stuff. We could have talked for hours and hours more. So to make it manageable, we're splitting the show into three parts, the Ganatra trilogy. So the next part is going to cover iOS to OS 10, and then the part after that is going to cover iPhone to iPad and iCloud. So stay tuned.